sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen. So you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcasts. That's gotomeeting.com/podcasts for a free trial. And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz, and you're listening to episode 80. It's a cloudy day out there, folks. It's been very rough, but what I thought I would do is bring in my good friend, Mish Shedlock, who is a blogger extraordinaire, an economist, a guy who has his eye to the market, his ear to the grindstone, if you will, and someone who I rely on for great information. So what I thought we'd do is go through this discussion directly and kind of link in and kind of talk about some of the things that there's so many things on this Mish, isn't it? There's a lot of things to talk about, right?
Absolutely, there's a lot of. you sound like when I was on Coast to Coast the other day, so many things I wanted to talk about, I couldn't even get them out. But certainly the stock markets themselves, you've got new lending facilities coming out of the Fed. We've got some action in treasuries to talk about. The moves in currencies have been absolutely nothing short of amazing volatility, just really all across the board. Commodities are certainly down. Oil, $65 or something?
Which is unbelievable.
So lots of things to talk about.
So let me ask you about currency. Let's just stop there, because you would think that with all the things going on in the U.S. that our currency would be hurt. You know, you would think that we'd have huge problems here because the fact that, you know, our economy is teetering on the brink of extinction, it seems. But why is it that the dollar is so strong, or is it really more of a function of a relative performance, and it's really not the dollar that's so strong, but it's everything else that has just totally been destroyed?
Actually, it's certainly the latter. And this is one of the things that I've gotten right personally. I talked about that today on my blog. By the way, people can do a Google search for Mish, M-I-S-H, find my blog. But I was talking today about the U.S. dollar, the yen, the treasuries. All those are soaring in risk aversion moves. And I had talked about this previously. I talked about this last summer. I was predicting the U.S. dollar index to hit 85 and then 90. It hit 86 today. And people, when I made that claim, thought it was totally nuts. But it is all relative performance. At the time that I was talking about that, I expected that interest rates in the UK and the EU were going to be headed lower. At the time, the expectation actually was that Europe and the UK were going to decouple. I mean, we've talked about this before. We both said how silly that decoupling theory was.
Right.
Well, not only did we recoupled with a big bang. And here we are, emergency rate cuts that were not planned in Europe, and actually Australia, New Zealand, other places, Canada, cut interest rates. And we're seeing a global slowdown of epic proportions here. So the demand for commodities, and especially crude, is falling off the roof. So that is pressuring some of the commodity carry trade countries like Australia, New Zealand.
Yep.
And certainly we know that Iceland blew up for different reasons. So we have all of that. And when you have a massive move down like this, it's the senior currency that usually wins. People are boiling out their carry trades. They're unwinding the carry trades in the yen, unwinding carry trades in the U.S. dollar. there was over leverage everywhere in the U.S. Financial sector, in commodities, and the commodities, you know, trading gold, trading dollar terms. So an unwinding of that benefits the senior currency. So all of that stuff adds up. It's not that the dollar is any good per se. It's that people have borrowed more in dollars than they can pay back because the assets on which they've purchased them are falling.
That's you and I talked way back when, as people thought you were crazy about the dollar back then. I actually went long the dollar, and we since have taken out that position. We made a decent money on it, but we took that out. But you know, I was very much skeptical about the whole oil issue, which everybody knows about. You know, $145 oil. I was saying this is just lunacy. You know, there's this reason. There's a balance that we have to have in the price of oil. Oil is a core commodity that we have to use no matter whether we like it or not, and whether we get it from this country or that country. It doesn't matter. The fact is we use oil for so many, not just our automobiles, so many different components of our entire economy and our whole manufacturing process. But what I think is interesting is there's an equilibrium point on oil. Now, at $150 or $200 per barrel, it's going to cause demand to just naturally just kind of, you know, dissipate a bit. But at $65, at $50, I think that the opposite situation is also true, that you can't just have oil going down to zero forever or not forever.
Oil's
but to
not
zero.
Going down to zero.
Right. I mean, I don't think it's going down to 30 either.
Not. I don't know if it goes down to 30. I think it can go down to 40. Why can't it? Let me say, why can't it go to 30? Although there might be some peak oil explanations, it really all depends on just how massive this. Two things. It depends on how massive the speculation was, and that's actually quite hard to quantify. But it also has to do with demand. So we had clearly when oil got to over 140, that last move up from 70 to 140, it doubled. There was no fundamental reason whatsoever for the price of oil.
But wait, Mish, wait. But at the time, these Goldman guys and all of these pundits were all over the place talking about 200 because of supply demand. And I don't understand. I'm not kidding. I don't understand. Why are we supposed to be listening to these stooges that are telling us this information when at the same time we know inherently it's not true?
Right. And this is what we did know. We knew it when gold was rising. This is, you know, these things always go higher. That last move is always way higher than anyone possibly thinks. You know, I thought when I was looking at this, it was clear to me that the global economy was slowing and slowing rapidly. It was at the time it was slowing faster in the U.S., but we are an enormous consumer of oil. So it's like, and everyone's telling me this, you know, the China story.
Oh, it was ridiculous.
The India story. I'm sorry. That's
right.
The tail wagging the dog
right.
When you start believing that
right.
Stuff. Now, maybe 20 years from now or 10 years from now or whenever, you know, China might be the dog. But now China is the tail. And so, you know, all of these people were chanting. Even the neighbor's kid was telling me the China story. And, you know, that's exactly like that shoe sign story. Shoeshine Boys story right before the Wall Street crash in 1929.
Yep.
That, you know, when the Shoeshine Boy is talking about something, well, you know, maybe, you know, we're at the top here. And, you know, but, you know, to an extent, though, China had that last massive splurge of imports, wanting to make sure they had every drop they needed and probably 10 times more for the Olympics. And then we had the fall off after that where demand just absolutely plunged. And speculators, I'm going to guess right now, I think I guessed before that speculation was 25% of these moves up. I'm now thinking maybe it's closer to 40. I don't know whether you've got an opinion on that or not.
I thought there was a huge amount of that, and I think that Morgan and Goldman and these guys knew that they had nothing else to play with right now because the financials were dropping out, and much of their play was really getting cremated on the real estate and mortgages, and they did what they can to really – because, again, I cannot tell you. I'm whipsawed here and just totally – I'm pissed, first of all. Let's just get that on the table. But I'm also very disappointed that it seems that we keep on getting the raw end of the stick. And, you know, we could pull up article after article and commentary after commentary and, you know, on big and small newspapers and TV, people talking about oil demand. And we all knew it was crap. And I don't understand how they could go on. I mean, I'm not trying to be naive, but I mean, I don't understand how they can try to swindle us. They swindled us.
Well, look at CNBC every day. Look at, you know, any of those sites. They're all predicated on can people tune into those sites because they want to hear. They want to hear good things. And it's very tough. They were cheerleading, you know, the bottom is in on the basis of the late rally we had at the end of this session. Every little bit of good news. You know what? We're not going to bottom until all these bottom callers stop calling bottom.
Right, exactly.
And I think that's what it boils down to. And you know what? I think we've got a long ways down from here.
Oh, let's get into that discussion, because I think that we do have a lot of problems. I'm not disagreeing with you. No, there's no disagreement here. But I do think that at the same time, there is, I think there's potentially a bottom that is far away for the major indices, but I think there are some sectors that have been obliterated. I keep coming back to oil. I'm going to come to the other side of oil and the oil and gas index, for example. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've seen that lately, but that the oil companies have been massacred. I mean, massacred. Now, I think that some of that has to do with the fact clearly about demand and oil and pricing and all those good things. I get that. But the other side of the coin is this whole idea that we're seeing this massive deleveraging, the requirement for hedge funds and getting with their margin calls, with getting out of whatever they have. These guys were big holders of the oil companies, big holders of the oil companies. And I think that what we're seeing now is an overstatement of, you know, when at the end of the day, these companies have to sell, they have to get out. Where are they going? Well, they're just selling everything just, you know, as they can. And
everything they can to raise cash.
Anything.
Actually, I agree with you. We're at Sitka, we're a little bit, you know, I don't know if bullish is the right word, but on a comparative basis, we like natural gas, actually. Some of the energy players in the natural gas realm. We're entering the winter heating season and demand. We don't know what the weather is going to be this winter, but if it's brutal, then demand will be there. But there's going to be demand for natural gas, regardless of what that is. You know, people might be able to stop driving their car, but they can't stop heating their house.
Right.
So, as on a fundamental basis, there, I probably like natural gas a little bit more than oil. And we certainly both know that oil, as you said earlier, is not going to zero. And I don't know whether it goes to 40 or 30 or 50. I'm pretty sure it's heading lower, you know. But the question is, you know, how much of that's priced in?
Right.
On the other hand, we have to remember here, where are earnings going to be? Look at you know, all the consumer discretionary stuff. Look at the stores. Target today reported increasing delinquencies on their credit cards. We're going to see that across the board.
Well, you know what? Let's talk about that for a second, because another thing, I got a couple of pet peeves I want to get out today. You know, for a while, I was really very hot and still hot on the whole idea that we have a rising credit issue. We have a lot of problems with Capital One Financial. We got stopped out a couple of times on Capital One because we use a certain strategy, and we're not going to let ourselves, you know, anything get run away from us. And the fact is, we got stopped out on one of our positions on Capital One. But more importantly, I want to tell you a story. There was a guy who was on our, and I tell the story, I'm going to tell it a little clearer now because I'm really aggravated. I had been talking with a gentleman who I respected very well from Barron's newspaper, and I got to tell you something. Barron's, I'm also pissed off at. I'll tell you why. They used to be the cream of the crop when it came to reporting. What happened to these guys? I mean, it used to be if Barron's said it, you would do it. I don't know about you. I would, you know, anybody. The figurative you. And Barron's now is just, it's like, you know, they're writing like immature, bullish bandits that just, you know, are doing nothing but kind of trying to, you know, pick up a story here or there. I talked to them about, you know, the delinquencies for months, and they said, well, it's not going to be over 4 or 5%. I said, what are you talking about?
10, wasn't it? 10 today from Target?
I mean,
10, was that a 10% increase?
No, 10% increase. Sure. But there was other projections I've been seeing generally that it's going to go to 7 or 7.5, which is going to be a historic high. And I don't understand, again, this bullish nonsense that people have to constantly bring to the story because they want things to be good. And I pissed off a lot of people. I keep using that word. I apologize. I made a lot of people angry about my negative discussions that I had about 3 months ago. And a few people wrote me and said, Andrew, you're never, you know, you're never positive. Everything is negative. I said, you know what? I'm just telling you as I see it. And as I see it right now, I see things like mutual funds. We talked about that earlier. We see mutual funds like the Fidelity Magellan down 45%. The CGM Focus Fund I'm looking at right now, year to date, down 45%. Down today, 9%. Down the other day, 8%, 2%, 5%. It's, you know, this is a serious situation we have going on right now. Individuals are shell-shocked. 401ks are now turned into 201ks, it seems. And I think that what I really want to hear is some straight story from somebody finally in the mainstream media. You know, we've been talking about it. You know, it's almost like the bloggers have got it right, the podcasters and the independents have gotten it right, and mainstream media and the pundits have just totally gotten this thing wrong. Would you disagree?
Oh, absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. The mainstream media certainly has got all of this wrong, and a lot of it is on purpose. They don't want people cashing out. They manage money. They have got a vested interest on the long side of the market, and CNBC and the news agencies have a bad news does not sell. They've got a vested interest to be bullish because that's what people want to hear. And but they're thoroughly discrediting themselves. It'll be interesting to see which ones of these places even survive. And, yeah. You know, and the likes of Cramer, you know, please, I don't even understand why anyone would watch that except for entertainment joke value. Yeah. But, you know, that's just my opinion. I suppose if you like him, you like him.
Yeah.
And you're entitled to like him, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just look at you know, kind of what we've done. You mentioned some places down 45%. You know, Legg Mason was down
Oof.
Huge,
Oof.
Well over 30%. And, you know, this is a guy that beat the S&P for 15 years straight running or something like that. And you know, but it's not about beating the S&P. It's really about having positive returns, if you ask me. And
one
of our strategies at Sitka, our hedge growth fund,
mm-hmm.
we're up. Hedge growth strategy is up about 13% on the year, which I think is doing really well. Another one of our
strategies. You think it's doing really well? Come on. When you look at
another one of our strategies is down about 5%. It's a long strategy where a lot of our IRAs are at.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in a normal market, I would not be very pleased actually to be down 5. But I think there are a lot of people who would love to be down 5. So here we are. So we're plus 13 and minus 5.
Yeah.
Average them together, we roughly have about equal money in those two strategies. And I think that's a good performance.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. I mean, especially when you see, you know, on the other side, like I said, these mutual funds down 45%. I don't know. Let me ask you. Let me switch over.
Let's finish a thought, though. Let's where to from here?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to get to. I was going to ask you your targets on the S&P. That's exactly what I was going to ask you. I was going to say, you know what? We are seeing, we know all what we're seeing. Historic this, historic that, you know, economic policy that's nauseating, socialistic tendencies from our government and you know, volatility that's just unheard of. S&P 500 markets, where are we going?
I think it's heading to 600. If that doesn't hold, 450. That's based on some technical analysis that we see playing out here. I've got an extremely clear. Now I just use Elliott Wave when it's extremely clear. And the count on the Elliott Wave is amazingly clear. It has to be amazingly clear for me to see it. I'm not that big of an Elliott Wave person, but I do use it, and usually I use it when it jumps out at me. And it absolutely jumped out at me. Then I said, okay, you know, that's what Elliott Wave is suggesting is likely to happen. That doesn't mean it will, but let's take a step back and look at.
Let me take a step back. How about getting me off the
floor?
Step back. How about getting me off the floor? I mean, that's a lot. That's a big number we're talking about.
That's a 50% decline. Well, not after today, but that's a huge, let's say 30% decline from here. Whatever it is, it's an enormous decline here. From here still, and there are fundamental reasons for that too. Unemployment is currently 6.1%. I personally have a forecast for unemployment to hit 8 next year, and I don't think it stops there. I think unemployment keeps rising until sometime in 2010, and then we're going to have a weak recovery off of that. But if housing and foreclosures are where they're at now, what do you think they're going to be like with unemployment 2% higher? There's going to be more people walking away. There's going to be more pressure on banks. It's no wonder these banks don't want to lend. And here we have Paulson trying to force these banks to lend at bazooka point, where he gave them this money whether they didn't want it or not. Most of them did. But if you don't know this story, the Treasury Secretary gathered the 9 largest banks in the country, put them in a room, put a single sheet of paper in front of them, and said, before you leave today, you have to sign this. And what they were signing on was that this was the taxpayer bailout, that these banks were going to get $125 billion, and then another $125 billion was going to go to, you know, another consortium of hundreds or possibly 1,000 banks or so. But these 9 banks got half of it, $129 billion. And they have to pay interest on that. And the interest they have to pay on that is 5%. But Merrill and Bank of America, Wachovia, some of these banks were looking at this and said, well, wait, not Wachovia, but Wells Fargo. Wait a second, what if we don't want this money? Says, well, you got to take it anyway. And charging them 5%, they can't lend it out. Anything they're likely to lend this out on is going to lose money. We don't need more Walmarts. We don't need more Pizza Huts. We don't need more strip malls. We don't need more nail salons. We don't need more anything. Anything they're likely to lend this money out to build or buy or do, with consumers retrenching the way they are, is likely to lose money.
Well, you make an assumption the banks are going to lend the money that they get.
Well, no, I'm making an assumption that they don't want to.
Of course not.
And then they're probably not going to. But now what are earnings going to do on the banks still? So they've got this money from the Fed, and they're going to sit on it. But right, they got to pay 5% interest on it. That's going to actually eat into their earnings way Paulson structured
the
deal.
You got to love it. And you know what? Let me throw the exact same scenario out to you in a different manner. I want you to follow me on this and tell me what you think, okay? This is something I've been drumming up over the last, I don't know, maybe 5 days. And frankly, we haven't acted on this yet because there's a point that you say, you know, should I short something if it's down at this point? If it just took a 30%, 40% retracement in the last month from where it was, do I want to get into something? Because it's dangerous, obviously. It could pop back. You know, all of a sudden you can have an announcement. Oh, no more shorting again. Hello. You know, or something like that, right? Now, take the same scenario you just laid out to me when it comes to the banks, right? And you have a bunch of money that's available. Well, we have $540 billion, which will get to your obvious question that I'm sure you're going to ask me, Mish, is where the heck are we getting $540 billion to put into the money market mutual funds to back them and backstop them? Bigger question I must ask is, why the heck do we need $540 billion to put into money market mutual funds? Do we have, 500, 520? Why 540? Do we have $540 billion worth of losses? Interesting. Second, money market mutual fund companies, take your pick, T. Rowe Price, Fidelity, whoever it is, they have huge losses inside of their portfolios. We just talked about the Fidelity Magellan Fund down 50% for the year. They're losing a lot of earnings because, obviously, 50% of their earnings are gone because they can't charge that. They've waived their loads on most of their money market mutual funds right now because they are underwater for the most part, and they got to make sure to keep up their interest, and they don't want to break the buck. Well, now this is a great source of income for them where they would put money usually, and a lot of people have taken the money out of the other things like the Fidelity Magellan and put it to the Fidelity money market, which they're not getting a fee on anymore. On top of that, they're getting more money forced down their throats that they're going to have to pay interest on. Same scenario you just built me. I'm throwing it onto another industry. Is the Treasury trying to choke off industry and trying to break the backs of these companies?
It's amazing what's going on here. I mean, just every month there's a new lending facility of some kind, and not only that, I believe they're counterproductive. There's a time. Well, I believe that from the beginning. It's not just like the additions that they're adding on. I don't think you fix problems by throwing more money at it. You don't fix sound banks by giving money to bad banks. And that's what we've done here. There are a lot of regional banks that didn't get caught up in this. And, you know, maybe instead of giving money to the bad banks, if we had to give money to someone, why don't you give it to those that have proven that they know what risk is? and still have good earnings. And so we're doing something fundamentally wrong here. The banks have every reason to sit on that money, and that's why, by the way, I'm still sticking with my deflation call. People tell me, look at all this money they're printing. And I have no idea where they're going to get it. You ask me, where does $540 billion come from? I don't print it. I don't know where it could other possibly come from.
Well, printing
it all seems illegal to me at this point.
Printing,
I don't think there's $540 billion there. Congress didn't authorize. They authorized, what, $350 billion? $250 billion right away. Another $100 billion that the president can ask for, but has not yet. So it's initial $250 billion. The Fed has, how much of their balance sheet have they gone through anyway?
I think the Fed's almost gone. Recently. I think the Fed's almost down on their, they were down to, they had $800 billion at the start of the year, right?
Mm-hmm. And so where do they have now?
It's light. If they're using any of this 540, it's almost at zero.
They got to be negative.
Right.
I agree with you.
Right.
I don't know where you come up with $540 billion. I don't think it can be done, which means whatever they're doing, in my opinion, is illegal.
But if it's illegal to what?
That's not stopping anyone.
Yeah,
right, but they can do whatever they want anyway.
Illegal according to whose law? They make the law. Who cares? Move on. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, so the fact of the matter is,
let's talk about the velocity of money here for a second. Now, that's a strange term because you get a different answer depending on what your definition of money is. You use M3, you get one answer. MZM, another answer. M0, M1. You know, you can get five different versions of velocity and.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than come up with a number, let's just talk about a theory here. There's a huge demand here for dollars. And one way we know that there's a huge demand for dollars is the value of the dollar is going up. And we can also see that those companies that we just talked about, Merrill Lynch, Wachovia, Goldman, they all said, they're going to be reluctant to lend this money that the Fed is forcing down everyone's throat. That's another sign of demand for dollars, whether anybody believes it or not. So here we have, all these printing presses running, and there's still this enormous demand for dollars.
And, I don't understand it. I don't understand it.
What's happening is the write-ups that are building on the asset sheets of these banks, all the stuff that's hidden in their level 3 assets, these defaults and losses to come, are still dwarfing the massive amount of printing that the Fed is doing. That's what it boils down to. That's why the dollar is still rising. That's why there's still a demand for dollars. And
when that gold ends, is
languishing.
Yeah,
here.
But when that ends, my friend, we have a flood of dollars on the market, and it will be like the bottom will fall out.
When does it end?
I don't know.
This can go on for another year. And people need to be very aware of that it can go on. And again, as also we talked before, the things are relative. We've got the same shenanigans going on in the UK and the EU. There's a $400 billion bailout of a bank in Germany. $400 billion. What is $400 billion to the German economy as compared to $400 billion to the U.S. economy?
Much more. Numbers. It's got to be tripled four times.
U.S. centric attitude, and they have to look at what's happening globally. The problems in Australia are immense. The housing bubble in Canada, particularly in Vancouver, is far worse than things got here, or maybe as bad as, let's say, things got in the worst places in Florida and California. That is a pretty nasty bubble, and at least we're somewhat through ours. Canada is just starting to. So, all of these forces are building up. The question is, when does Bretton Woods unravel?
Well, it is starting to unravel if you consider that it takes its form in different ways. For example, it takes its form in Iceland going under. That had obviously a lot of consequence from things that are going on. It takes its form in the fact that Argentina is basically raiding the cookie jar of its people. It's taking money from the pension plan to backstop its own mess, which cannot be good. I don't know about you, but I have this funny feeling that if the government decided to enter my 401k plan and borrow it for a little while, I would not be happy.
And you wouldn't have a say. But you know what? Is the same thing going to happen here?
Well, let me tell you something.
Look at all this stuff. that Bernanke and Paulson have done, and one can only sit back and say, what are they going to do if it gets any worse?
Gets any worse? Let me read you something.
What are they going to do when it gets worse? Because we know it's going to get worse.
Let me read you something. This is from actually a friend of mine, Howard Silverblatt. He's been on the show a few times, from Standard & Poor's. And he wrote a research note recently that talks about that last year there was a $63 billion overfunding in the S&P 500 companies in their pension plan, right? Which was great. It was a level that wasn't seen since 1995. And it was great, okay? But because of the current market fluctuations and all these things, he is looking at, this is unbelievable, that the funds, the pension funds, could suffer an underfunding amount right now greater than $219 billion.
I don't doubt it at all. CalPERS, the California pension plan, down 20% on the year. That's not coming back. And remember, their pension assumptions are something like, 8-9% a year. Not going to happen. Even when the market recovers, it's not going to shoot back all at once, just like that. Now, maybe we get a snapback at some point of 8-9. I mean, we've certainly seen we've seen snapbacks of 8-9% every week now.
Yeah,
that just turn right around and fail.
Right.
But unless one is day trading this, and trust me, you can't day trade $1 trillion or whatever CalPERS is sitting on. Would affect the market.
Yeah,
too much.
They're
a stuck participant, if you would.
Right.
And there's nothing they can do about it.
Right.
And what happens? What do those pension plans look like? They're underfunded now. What do they look like if the S&P hits my target at $600? What does it look like then?
I don't know, but let me just finish this one thing that he says also, which really troubles me. He says the deficit will have to be dealt with through large, unplanned cash infusions, which will be difficult given tight liquidity in the market.
Who said that?
This is Howard Silverblatt from Standard & Poor's. Boy, I tell you something, when Standard & Poor's gets going, they really get going. I mean, they laid off for a long time.
The problem.
Yep.
Let's just look at things in simple terms. We are in this mess because of unsound lending practices.
Correct.
So you cannot fix unsound lending practices by getting banks to lend unsoundly. And worse yet, robbing the taxpayer to give to money so the banks to lend unsoundly, back to the people that loaned the money to the banks. It's incredible what's going on here. And it cannot work. And how Bernanke can't see this is simply beyond me.
Well, let me tell you something. You make far too much sense, my friend, okay? That's one of the problems, all right? The second thing is, maybe Bernanke sees it. Maybe he does. He's not stupid. Come on. We know he's not stupid. Maybe
he's
dense.
He's got a PhD, but he doesn't have any common sense.
Well, maybe he does. Maybe he doesn't have a choice. Seriously. Maybe he doesn't have a choice. Maybe things are really bad. Listen, did you see when he was the other day, maybe 4 days ago, he was talking about there is a need for another stimulus package that needs to be very large and, what was the word he used? He used a very interesting word. He said that it needs to be very, direct and very substantial.
Now, I think he said targeted, too.
Yeah, but the word substantial was in there. And let me ask you, when the Fed Reserve chief is saying after let's just use a round number for trillion for a moment here, okay? $1 trillion here, $500 billion there that's already been pushed in, and not to mention the daily open allowances that he's been flooding the market with. Don't you think there's a lot more behind this?
That's I do. And and it's all hidden in those level 3 assets on the balance sheets of banks. It's hidden in, not even hidden. Well, those are hidden. And let's talk about that for a second, because that's one of the reasons why no one trusts banks, is they suspended the mark-to-market rules as if that's going to help. It's not going to help because now we know that the problems that the banks have, we know that those problems are there, but the market doesn't like uncertainty. Now it doesn't know how big those problems are and what needs to be done about them. So that does not inspire confidence in the stock market. It's yet another reason for the stock market to go down, And it's another reason why the actions that they're taking are going to fail. Mm-hmm. And I lost my train of thought here. So ask your question again here. I'm sorry.
No, my point was, we start off with, is Bernanke, you know, stupid? And we said no. And then we said, you know, is it the fact that Bernanke really knows this? And isn't there a lot more of a problem behind it if he, in fact, is saying, hey, we have a big problem?
Yeah, a lot more behind it. Yeah, there's a lot more behind it. And it's going to get worse because of the rising unemployment. Because of the walkaways, people are going to be walking away from their houses, and banks are scared to death. And he could throw another $1 trillion at this problem, and it wouldn't do a thing, in my estimation.
Yeah.
It wouldn't do a thing.
Right.
It wouldn't cause inflation right now. It wouldn't go anywhere. It would sit there. Banks still wouldn't lend it. It would be a big problem going down the road, but it really wouldn't do much of anything right now. Other than, you know, maybe collapse the dollar and make things worse or cause interest rates to rise, which is another thing. You know, had they just let this thing play out, the long bond had been collapsing.
Mm-hmm.
And had they not printed all of this money, it's likely that Treasury rates would have continued down. Instead, we saw roughly... Well, they're back to where they were now because Treasury's rallied huge today, but when the Fed started this printing campaign to bail out these banks, the 10-year Treasury rose 70 to 100 basis points. That's immediately reflected in mortgage costs.
Right.
So all of this stuff they're doing is counterproductive. We've got mortgage rates are higher than where they were a year ago, in spite of the Fed fund rate being where it's at. Now, had they just slashed the interest rates, which I also think is actually counterproductive, but printing all of this money spiked the long-term interest rates up or is holding them up, so homeowners aren't getting any benefit from all of these rate cuts that the Fed has done. Everything they do has a negative reaction somewhere else, and not all of the things they're doing even make any sense. Well, mm-hmm. Bernanke thought he could put a floor on interest rates by what did they do? They Congress passed the law this last time. Oh, to pay interest on reserves. That's
right.
What I was going.
Reserve,
they passed
right.
this law to pay interest on reserves.
Mm-hmm.
Bernanke thought that would put a floor on interest rates. Well, it didn't. We see we're down. He's cut already. He wanted to defend too. And I think we got another rate cut coming, so we're going to be back down to one before we know it. So not only did he not get a floor, but as long as he can pump all of this money in now, why do banks want to lend money to each other when they've got all these additional pawn shop operations going on with the Fed?
Right.
So it did not spur bank-to-bank lending.
Yeah.
All of these things that the Fed is doing, they're starting to interfere with each other.
Yeah, I have so many things that still are on my mind, but let's just keep this very short and wrap this up. But let me just tell you a few things that are on the front page of the Wall Street Journal and in some articles I've been reading really quickly. I just want to kind of very quick. Ready? This is I'm very troubled here. Really, I'm not kidding. I'm very troubled. Here we go. CalPERS may lift contribution rate. CalPERS plans to tap California public employees for more money if its heavy investment losses don't reverse. Did I say
Argentina?
Wait, did I say
Argentina? Tap employees for the pension plan?
Did I say Argentina or CalPERS? What did I say?
I said you said CalPERS.
Oh yeah, it is CalPERS. That's right. Let's see. The nation's largest public pension fund said it intends to tap California public employees for more money if its heavy investment losses don't reverse. They would be have assets that declined. Their assets declined $48 billion, and unless the returns improve, CalPERS is poised to impose an estimated increase in employer contributions. Unbelievable.
Wow. Well, the pension, as I told you, the pension plan assumptions are way too high. And there's going to be no way they can meet those assumptions.
I have more.
Go ahead.
Let me throw a few more out to you. This is quite disturbing. Credit card losses may scale new peaks. Big problems in the financial crisis shown that history is unreliable guide for gauging any kind of you know, numbers, and it looks like that, you know, when you look at the Citigroup, J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, American Express, and Capital One, my favorite, we're talking about 1990s, it was 7.69. In 2002, it was 7.69, but it looks like it could eclipse that dramatically. That's another front pager or in there, which is quite remarkable. Then, on top of that, Michigan is pushing for car support because they need to have they're urging Bernanke and Paulson to promote liquidity in the U.S. auto industry. They're having such difficulty.
Bail out of Ford and GM.
Which is should not happen, in my opinion.
I agree. Where's that money coming from?
Honestly, I'd rather you bail out the banks than I would the car companies, if I had a choice. If I had a choice. I don't like either, but if I had a choice. There's also discussion about, of course, we know that the euro and the pound are dropping sharply again. That was all happening. But there was one more point that I wanted to bring up here that I saw that really was troubling to me. AIG is agreeing to freeze executive pay cuts. Amazon is tempering their sales. Let's see here. Here it is. Here's one. There's two things. Europe is again. Actively managed funds struggle amid crisis. Here's what we talked about again. Fidelity and Legg Mason. Legg Mason's value fund down 48% for this year. Expense ratio of 1.68 he's charging for that. And they're talking about Fidelity Magellan with about 0.75%. It's down more than 40% this year, which is worse than its peers and the S&P. And AIG has some funds. Let's see. It just keeps going and going. I mean, the bad news just doesn't seem to stop, does it?
No, the bad news doesn't stop, and there's no reason for it to stop. I don't think it stops. I mean, unemployment's a lagging indicator. But here, I mean, clearly we're in recession. I mean, we said
really?
We're in recession in January.
What are they going to tell us?
Acting as if we're done. every day I read an article that says the Fed is worried we might be going into a recession. It's ludicrous, but that's the talk.
Right.
And we'll see. It'll be pronounced. And looking ahead, we need to. I think it's clear that Obama's going to win the election. Whether you like it or not, it's clear that he is.
And 10-point favorite right now.
A statement of likelihood. I don't know what could change that unless Bush did something dramatic like blowing up Iran tomorrow or something. outside of that, we need to look and see to figure out what's really going to happen. We need to figure out, what the next Congress is going to do. You know, how much are they going to spend? Where are they going to spend? Are they going to, cut back on spending on wars and spend more in the United States? Or are they going to try and do both, keep spending money on wars and, keep spending money we don't have here? So some of what is going to happen with the U.S. dollar, with gold, with other things, is going to depend on what the next administration is going to do. I've got my fingers crossed, but not a lot of hope, personally, that Obama actually does the right thing and slashes military spending and brings the troops home and, cuts out a lot of that military expense. That's more of a hope, and not more of a hope, that is entirely a hope as opposed to a belief. On the other hand, I know what McCain would do, and that's keep spending money on bombs to fight wars. So that's just my personal belief, but I mean, they've pretty much stated that, or at least McCain has. He's willing to stay in Iraq for 100 more years if necessary, but we need to see. And I'm hoping that some of the things that Obama is saying is under the grounds of election posturing that he really doesn't do, but because I'm certainly not in favor.
You don't think a tax increase will be beneficial now?
Tax increase. I don't think he's going to increase tax.
No, no
well,
kidding.
Increase taxes. He's got a tax redistribution scheme that I'm personally in favor of a flat tax. I think that's where we ought to be headed. But realistically, I don't think that his tax plan is going to do any more damage than the one that's in place right now. It might even help versus what we've got now. But it won't help versus what I think needs to be done is go to a flat tax and a consumption tax, get rid of the IRS, get rid of a lot of these legal, you know, things that allow everyone to shelter money, and really make it a flat tax. I think the rates would go down across the board.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in fantasy land, or anyone's in fantasy land if they think that's going to happen under this Congress. So, it's not.
Yep. So let's just wrap it up with this and a couple things. I just want to mention to everybody that what's the minimum account size for new accounts, by the way?
$50,000 for our hedge growth strategy, $125,000 for absolute return, and hedge growth is suitable for non-IRAs only. You can't short in IRAs. Right now, that's for non-IRA money. That's certainly our preferred vehicle here right now.
Mm-hmm.
We really, I mean, a lot of hedge funds have said that they don't care which way the market goes. We've proven that we don't care which way the market goes.
Yep.
We're up 13%,
right.
I think that's kind of proof in
it. Yeah, that's great. That's good. You know, as long as I say, it doesn't matter which way the market goes, as long as it's open, that's what's good.
And during options expiration week, how many surprise announcements have we seen out of the Fed that's caused a rip-roaring rally of somewhere, only to give it back immediately after options expiration?
Yeah, crazy.
Quite amazing. And it makes it very hard for some people to trade.
No, it's impossible. And I think that one thing I want to say in closing is this, that hope, prayer, wishes is no place in this particular market environment. And, you know, even though John Bogle, brilliant guy, and all the powers be at Fidelity and everywhere seem to say that you need to buy and hold, you know, I don't know, maybe they have a lot more money than we do, but buying and holding in this kind of environment, and you may say, well, now, why would you sell now? It's so low. But we could have said that, you know, over the last several months. And you know, been a lot better off.
But also remember my targets. I'm still targeting the S&P for another 30-50% decline.
Even if you're wrong, by the way, for 50%, even if you're 50%, I'm still upset. You know, even if you're 50% wrong, I'm not too happy about that.
Yeah.
Well, we'll wrap this up.
My technical and fundamental read, and sorry to perhaps add to the ongoing depression out there, but. But you know what, Andrew? We got to give people the straight story, what we believe, and that's what we do here. And with that, it's a pleasure to be on your show, to have the opportunity to, you know, talk about these things in a straightforward manner and provide information to people that's certainly a lot different than one's going to get on CNBC.
Yep. Well, with that, I encourage everybody to check out his site. We'll put a link on our site for Sitka Pacific, and to check out Mish, again, just put in Mish in Google and you'll find him right away. And I encourage you to check out his various money management processes, because I think right now a lot of people are looking for help and really need to do something rather than be in those stodgy old mutual funds that are really doing nothing for them. So, Mish, thanks so much for the information, and we'll talk to you real soon.
Pleasure to be, and we'll catch you in another month.
What a great conversation. This is it's a very, very difficult time with all the volatility we're seeing in the markets. The VIX at an all-time high. Continuing to see just, you know, the questionable antics of our government stepping in to try to save us, but yet, you know, seemingly setting off chain reactions in almost every market around the world is causing huge problems. But with that, I think that if you check out Strategy Lab, the strategy that we just employed was to buy on the dips and to utilize some of the strategy that was going against us in our favor. How do we do that? Well, one of the things I did was I started to think about what was really happening with our sell stops and why were we bleeding a little bit in terms of you know, getting hit on those stops, because I wanted to protect myself. What we did was we reversed engineered it. We said, you know, if we're getting hit on the stops, let's take our buy prices way down. So we said, you know what, right now it's not a great time to be in individual equities just for the moment till things calm down, because anything can happen to any one of them due to earnings or some other kind of infection, if you will, from the other markets and the other earnings from companies that are similar to them in the same sector. So what we did was we utilized the ETFs, and we said, okay, if, for example, the ETF range right now is from 10 to 15, which is kind of extraordinary, but maybe the real estate or the materials is having that kind of a fluctuation, well, why don't we start buying it in increments below where we believe it is even possible to move down? And if we do buy it at such a low price, maybe 30% on the daily volatility, on the range of the daily, maybe there's something that we can benefit. And already we've done so three times in the last couple of days and actually profiting very nicely on that. So that's one way to take a look at it, really go outside the range you think is possible, because right now the impossible is very possible. In addition to that, I want to make you aware of something. We're writing a major story on and a major research piece on the mutual fund industry. It will be appearing on MSM's Top Stocks, as well as a link on our site. I encourage you to read this. It's something you really need to take a look at if you're really serious about investing and what's going on with the mutual fund industry from the aspect of where is it going, but also where's the profitability. We already shorted a few of these companies, which I will leave it to you to go check out the website and see which ones we're talking about. But we already shorted them for actually about a 15% profit in the last couple of days. The other thing I want to mention in closing is that I want to make sure that you know to join me in the nation's capital for the 4th annual Money Show Washington, D.C., November 6th through the 8th, 2008, at the Wardman Park Marriott. You can actually hear from about 50 different world-class experts and me somewhere in that group. There's quite a bit that you could learn there in the 170 free workshops that they have, where you really can have every opportunity to refresh your perspective and prepare yourself for the new political landscape. We're going to be right there after the election. And really, you can meet face-to-face with about 125 different investment companies and evaluate the products and services they designed. And I think it's going to be something you could really enjoy. You can call, make reservations, or get your tickets at 800-970-4355. Be sure to mention the priority code 011302. Or visit the Money Show Washington, D.C. website. I'll have a link on our website for that. In addition to that, let me give you the number again just in case you need it. 800-970-4355 and priority code 011302. Finally, I just want to mention to you that if you hadn't had the opportunity to attend the cyber trading class that I taught, it was great. We just did one recently. There's another one that's going to be happening on the 4th of November and on the 11th of November. Make sure that you sign up. It is free, and it's about an hour course online. Pretty cool. We're going to be talking about portfolio mastery and really focusing in on hedging and protection strategies. So if your portfolio has been a little bit wonky these days, maybe it's something that you want to take a look at, okay? With that, we're going to sign off here and hope you have a great weekend. This weekend is a big event in my family. We have a bar mitzvah for my son, Brett. So I'm pretty excited about that. So we're going to be partying all weekend. Lots of family from around the country is coming in. So officially, a congratulations to Brett. He doesn't really listen, but I thought I'd say it anyway. And thanks so much for listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is episode number 80. Oh, by the way, Nouriel Roubini is scheduled for the 4th or 5th, somewhere around the first week or so of November. And next week, we have the entire Strategy Lab panel from MSN Money going to be appearing on this. So be sure to make sure that you stay subscribed. Stay tuned. Thanks for listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.